Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So what do we know about the economy today that we didn't know yesterday? Just one thing, if you really think about it, that the number of jobs in this economy continues to fall. 51,000 fewer at the end of July than at the beginning, almost 500,000 less since the beginning of the year. I'd say that should be an item on a recession checklist, wouldn't you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Friday. It's August the 1st today. And welcome to the inaugural Marketplace Recession Checklist, a handy list of things to look for as you try to figure out whether we're in one or not.
Item 1, the housing market.
New home sales are down. Used home sales are down. Construction companies, home supply stores, they're all down. Prices are down. So yes, as far as the housing sector is concerned, it's a recession.
Item 2, unemployment.
There are two numbers to look at with unemployment. The rate, which we learned today, has hit 5.7%, a four-year high, and the number of jobs in the economy, down 51,000 last month, the seventh consecutive month of declines. A recession indicator? Probably.
Item 3, consumer spending.
This one's actually closely tied to the jobs number and the wages we get for having a job. They're not really keeping up with inflation. Although spending was reasonably solid last quarter, thanks mostly to the tax rebate checks. So let's put this one in the toss-up column.
Item 4, gross domestic product.
The classic definition of recession is two straight quarters of a shrinking GDP, even though nobody really goes by that anymore. Still, we've only had one quarter of negative economic growth so far, the last one of last year. So by that very academic measurement, nope, not a recession. There are a million more things we could have thrown on that list, but hey, the show only lasts a half an hour, right? Today's Wall Street Journal, on the other hand, ran about 48 pages, and it had Walmart in its crosshairs right on page one. The Journal's reporting that the biggest company in the country has politics on its mind. It says that in the past few weeks, Walmart has warned thousands of supervisors about the economic peril of a Democratic win in the fall. That would make it easier for workers to unionize, the company says, and hurt the bottom line. At a time when companies are already struggling with high fuel costs and a slow economy, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that Walmart's not the only one worried about labor getting organized.
Business groups have chipped in $50 million to fight the Employee Free Choice Act. Barack Obama backs the bill, and opponents fear a new Congress will pass it. Glenn Spencer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says if the bill becomes law, there would be some big economic consequences.
Well, there's little doubt that you would see a pretty widespread increase in union organizing efforts, and particularly, we think, among small businesses. There's certainly a potential to see labor costs rise.
Right now, though, unemployment is rising. Wages are stagnating, and most unions are hemorrhaging members. In fact,
American workers have been facing steadily declining real wages and squeezed paychecks.
Jared Bernstein at the Economic Policy Institute says American workers don't have the clout right now to bargain for cost of living increases. But Jeffrey Rubin, chief economist at CIBC World Markets, thinks wage hikes could be just around the corner.
Now, people might scoff at that notion, saying that in today's world, that's untenable facing the onslaught of cheap labor from China. But I think that's yesterday's world.
Rubin believes sky-high oil and shipping costs are making U.S. goods more competitive at home. That, along with reinvigorated unions, could help workers in a range of businesses, from furniture to steel, win wage concessions. But policymakers and businesses fear a jump in wages would usher in a return to 70s-style inflation. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Here's the most recent glimpse of how bad it is in the airline industry. As of today, U.S. Airways wants its passengers to pay for in-flight beverages. So that'll be $2, please, for everything from soft drinks to bottled water. Coffee's only a dollar. But notice how carefully we phrased that. U.S. Airways wants you to pay. You might think your options are limited, locked in an aluminum tube at 35,000 feet. But there's a loophole, as Marketplace's Bob Moon explains.
United Airlines once ran a commercial suggesting the idea of in-flight beverages was as old as the two-seater.
Let me get this straight. You want coffee on the plane while we're
You're
in the
flying
air?
Friendly sky.
The industry isn't laughing anymore, though, about the millions spent every year on thirsty passengers. And even though U.S. Airways is the only major carrier charging for beverages so far, you can wager its rivals are watching carefully to see how it's accepted. Mike Flores speaks for the U.S. Airways chapter of the Association of Flight Attendants. He complains the carrier is already making vague exceptions for free drinks if someone needs water to take a pill or maybe orange juice because they have low blood sugar or just feel dehydrated. And he fears this is where many passengers sick of being nickel and dimed will draw an angry line.
If we see that confrontational behavior, you know, we are going to give away free drinks.
An industry consultant on this kind of a la carte pricing, Jay Sorensen, says bad blood between U.S. Airways and its flight attendants union could doom this new policy.
I mean, if you are creating an environment in which you're motivating passengers to become unruly to get a free drink, don't be surprised if that happens.
Sorensen says beverage fees have been accepted in Europe, and with operating costs so high, many carriers here may have no other choice. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Given that jobs report and GM's $15 billion loss could have been way worse for the major indices today, we'll have the details and the week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. The United Nations AIDS program reported some good news this week. Fewer people are dying of the disease and more patients are getting medication to treat their HIV. Still, the UN said countries ought to keep on putting money aside for treatment and prevention. Funding is going to be one of the big issues at the International AIDS Conference that kicks off this Sunday in Mexico City. Science Magazine correspondent John Cohen is going to be there. He's written a series of stories on HIV/AIDS funding for the magazine. Mr. Cohen, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How much are we spending now on AIDS prevention and treatment globally versus, say, 10 years ago?
If you combine all the money spent by middle and low income countries and all the donations that come from wealthy countries, it's about $10 billion a year. A decade ago, that was about $450 million. So it's jumped about 20-fold.
Well, why that huge increase?
The huge increase was triggered by lots of factors, but I think the principal thing is that drugs started to work. By 1996, a lot of these drugs started to come to market. They just weren't available to most of the world because most of the HIV-infected people in the world live in poor countries. And then in 2000, the International AIDS Conference was held in Durban. And that was the first time it was ever held in Africa, really at the epicenter of the epidemic. And the fact that the meeting was held there just catalyzed this outcry that this great injustice was happening. After that meeting, several new mechanisms came about, plus the generic drug industry came forward very aggressively and said, we can make these drugs and we're going to do it.
Tell me about those mechanisms. Where is the money coming from?
There are four players with really deep pockets. One is a global fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Another is the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. The World Bank is a huge contributor, and the fourth one is the Gates Foundation.
What's the mechanism, though? Are they outright grants? Do you have to go through governments? How do you do it?
Each one of these programs is very different. PEPFAR goes into a country, puts people on the ground, sets things up, and delivers treatment and prevention campaigns and prevention efforts. The Global Fund, in contrast, wants countries to do it on their own. They want to build local capacity. And these are grants. It's, you know, essentially free money. The World Bank does both credits and grants. The Gates Foundation has put about $2 billion into HIV/AIDS research, treatment, prevention. It dwarfs every other foundation in terms of its assets and also in terms of its giving.
I wanted to ask you about distribution. And let's just take, as an example, Africa, since that's where so much need is. Are the countries who need global AIDS money getting it?
I looked at the hardest hit countries in the world, which are all in sub-Saharan Africa. And I asked the question, how many dollars have been dispersed to them, how many dollars have been committed, and how many HIV-infected people do they have? And what I found were there were great disparities. So there are some extremely hard-hit countries, Zimbabwe, for example, are in political turmoil, that have a hard time writing good grants, that the U.S. government doesn't want to give money to, that really aren't getting much aid at all. And then there are other countries like Ethiopia, which has more committed money than any country in the world, which in a relative sense doesn't have as bad of an epidemic as many other countries.
What's the answer then? With this amount of money on the line and obviously the social costs and risks, what's the policy prescription for fixing Global AIDS Foundation money?
There is no global architecture for health. One potential solution is to find ways to help these fragile countries write better grant proposals.
Kind of funny that AIDS relief comes down to your ability to do the paperwork.
And it also comes down to donor darlings. You know, everybody likes to think that foreign aid is somehow equally distributed. Well, it's not. It's always tied up with politics when it's bilateral.
John Cohen did the reporting for the pieces in the special issue on AIDS HIV funding. It's in Science magazine. Mr. Cohen, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Book readership is down, but we're doing our best to change that. Our series of Marketplace Beach Reads wraps up today with this last recommendation from one of our commentators. You probably know people in your office who plaster their cubicles with stuff like kitten calendars and motivational sayings, right? Commentator and economist Tyler Cowen introduces us to a book that wonders what all that stuff tells us about all those people.
There's an art and a science to figuring out how people tick. One way we do it is by studying their possessions, their bedrooms, and their workspaces. We all love to play detective. But Sam Gosling, a psychologist from the University of Texas, elevates detective work to an art in his new book, Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Here's a brief snooping field guide. Too many awards in an office can indicate that a person feels underappreciated. If a woman shakes your hand firmly, she's probably more open to new experiences, or so the studies indicate. If you use I, me, and my a lot in your speech and writing, you tend to be low status, depressed, and possibly even suicidal. Music is the best topic for turning a stranger into a friend, and lots of inspirational posters are a sign of potential neuroticism. Context matters, and you need to scan as much information as possible. Many of the lessons of the book are about avoiding common mistakes. Contrary to what people often infer, a neat room doesn't signal an agreeable person, and a colorful, bright room doesn't indicate a conscientious person. If you're judging conscientiousness, look for formal dress but not fluent speech or calm speaking, two other false signals. If you're looking for neuroticism, dark clothing is a good clue, although we tend to look, mistakenly, for a weak or halting manner of speech. This book will hold your attention, but I wonder if there isn't always another clue to ponder. The snoop in me asks what it means that Sam Gosling wrote this book. And I'm sure he had veto power over the green cover and the keyhole image on the front. In the author's photo, he has longish hair, a slight frown, and he's wearing a short-sleeve T-shirt. His webpage has lots of testimonials to the book's quality. That's a bit like Larry, the guy in the book with all the plaques, trophies, and awards in his office. As the author writes, most of us like to know we are appreciated. So is Gosling brilliant or simply fooling around? If you're not sure, that's the problem, but it's also part of the fun.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. You can see more recommendations for the best Marketplace Beach Reads at our website. It's marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street. Stockbroker, business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas is with us to do that. So how's August treating you so far, buddy?
Well, I don't know. It kind of looks like July. They play with us, little up, little down.
Yep.
But it is the dog days. Did you see the volume today?
No, that's your job.
Less than 1.25 billion shares. And in fact, today marked the first day we didn't see a triple-digit move either up or down in the Dow Jones Industrials Average. This thing is comatose.
How come? I mean, it's not like there isn't trading and business to be had.
Exhaustion. and people are taking off for the summer. And the fact is they feel comfortable enough to take off for the summer. We've sort of wound through a lot of the earnings season, and We do have the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meeting next week, so I guess they'll come back around for that. We got the employment numbers out today, and I don't know. It's, if you squint real hard, you can say we dodged a bullet on that one. So now we can sit back, you know, without a lot of volume and a lot of people around, and do a little reflecting and sort of look at the numbers that are in front of us and try to see the darn forest for a different
Well,
for
do
a
that
change.
For me. I mean, you know, as you sit back here at the beginning of what's going to be a really slow month, I don't know what we're going to talk about the next 3 weeks, what do you see?
Well, it's interesting. I'm beginning to see some trends, but I'm looking at the earnings that are coming out and well, and the events. You know, earlier this week we were reporting that Steak and Ale and Bennigan's are just going to liquidate. They're going to go. And I can cite, I mean, just in my area, and I'm sure you can in your area, lots of individual restaurants that have folded.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you think, well, you know, maybe people are actually going to change. That people didn't used to go out and eat 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week. So we may not need as many restaurants. Then you look at car sales, and you've seen, have you seen the mix, the dichotomy in car sales today?
Yeah, yeah, but why don't you explain it actually? Because it's,
well,
it's
the big
number.
Ones, I mean, the big guys, the ones that are selling the big V8s and the Hummers and the four-door this and that's and the SUVs, obviously not doing well. Truck sales are just, you know, going straight down. But you know what they can't get enough of these is, and I'll give you some industry jargon if you don't know it here.
Go ahead.
Four bangers.
Which would be what? Oh, four-cylinder engines.
Exactly. Yeah. Cars that have a lot of get up and go, and they don't use a lot of gasoline. I think, you know, maybe more people are going to use those.
So,
and oh my goodness, I'm a big newspaper reader, and I know you are too. And it was painful to watch the earnings coming out of all the newspaper companies. But I think there's a big change coming there.
So you think this is permanent? I mean, you think really this is now behavioral shift on the part of the consumer?
I think it is quite likely, and I think travel is going to be the same way.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen next week, right?
What's that?
Gas is going to go to like $3.75, and everybody's going to buy Hummers and SUVs again.
Ooh, they're going to be on sale, aren't they? I forgot
that's,
about
that's
that.
Right. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Coming up, wildfire through a firefighter's eyes.
It's absolutely wonderful. And, I mean, that's hard to use those words about something that, as devastating as it is. But it's nature at its finest.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials finished down 51 points this Friday, around 0.5% to 11,326. The NASDAQ dropped 14 points, 0.2%, finished at 2310. The S&P 500 lost 7 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 1260 this week. For the week that was, the Dow lost 0.4%. The NASDAQ ended flat, and the S&P 500 managed to tack on 0.2%. You can blame weak manufacturing numbers for sliding metal prices that crumpled the value of Alcoa by nearly 5%. Shares of Caterpillar, they make bulldozers and mining excavators, of course, also dug the Dow a deeper hole. Shares in the heavy equipment maker dropped 2% today. The huge second quarter loss at General Motors also weighed heavily on the Dow. The struggling automaker stock fell more than 7.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for June. President Bush takes off for Asia. Air Force One is scheduled to make a stop in Alaska, where the president will talk to troops. And jazz musician Louis Armstrong was born on August 4th in 1900 or 1901. What a wonderful world. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a great weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. All across Oklahoma this weekend, Native Americans are holding a series of tribal powwows. It's a thing that happens every summer. Some of them are going to be simple tribal dances. Others are going to feature picnics, fireworks, and thanks to the casinos that are on many of those reservations, a chance to win the jackpot. As that casino business has grown, prizes for the best powwow dancers have grown, too. And that money's created a class of powwow professionals, as Sonia Geis reports now from Albuquerque.
Rusty Gillette is like a Native American idol. Last year, he won first place in a midnight dance contest in front of 22,000 screaming people. Gillette is a powwow professional. He's a graphic artist during the week, but he travels every weekend to dance.
As a whole, I do okay, you know, enough to be able to have a chance to win, which is really fortunate for me.
Gillette's being modest. His beaded outfits are recognized across the country. Last year's first place finish was at the Gathering of Nations in Albuquerque, the biggest powwow of the year. 3,000 dancers compete for $1,500 cash prizes or a trip for two to Hawaii. Powwows used to be local get-togethers, but now that casinos sponsor big dance contests, winners travel a circuit that stretches from Los Angeles to Canada. Some older Native Americans are worried about cultural changes that they see at these contests.
I started dancing back in 1952 when powwow wasn't the way it was. There was no competition. It was just starting to be born back in about then. And
Boy Ladd is from the Ho-Chunk Indian tribe in Wisconsin. He competes too, but he has mixed feelings about turning traditional dance into a profession. Ladd says money can change the meaning of the dances. Powwows typically celebrate warriors. Ladd is a Vietnam veteran. He says the dances allow him to describe his war experiences.
The songs that are made, the steps, the movements that we do when we're dancing, tell a story. Tell a story about our experiences, actual combat situations, and you exemplify that as you dance through your movement, your headdress, all parts of your body.
Ladd moves with rhythm and dignity on the dance floor. But the crowds really go wild for the younger men's contests with their show-offy steps and glittering outfits.
Today, the footwork, the regalia is far more fluorescent, beautiful, but definitely more expensive than it was, say, 50 years ago.
Women's dancing is graceful and modest, but that may be changing too. Gladys Jefferson is a member of the Crow tribe in Montana. She says she's seen young people put on their powwow outfits and act like they're at a nightclub.
The East Coast and the West Coast really having this hip-hop dancing, and they're doing dirty dancing, you know, with grass dance and stuff. And, you know, people were really upset on the reservation, you know.
Jefferson says no one has dared to do any dirty dancing in front of her. She saw it
on YouTube.
Powwow celeb Rusty Gillette acknowledges the complaints about commercialization. But he says the powwows give dancers a chance to travel and learn about other tribes. He says these dances are still more about community than competition.
There's a lot of people here that are here to see the powwow. They're here to dance. They're here to sing. They're not here to take first place.
Casino money is a controversial issue among Native Americans. Some argue it's helping sustain their communities. Others say it's eroding traditional aspects of their culture. Even members of tribes that don't have casinos can see changes to their way of life. All they have to do is head to a powwow. In Albuquerque, I'm Sonia Geis for Marketplace.
So far this summer, we've brought you profiles of a surf instructor and a Jeep tour guide, among others. Today, though, we bring a whole new meaning to the term hot jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
California's been hit real hard by wildfires the past couple of months. A lot of them have been up in Northern California, so we went to meet a man who battles the blazes.
Why do I fight fire? Part of it is I like the adrenaline. You know, but it's also a matter of protecting my community. I'm Gene Dunning. I work for Butte County Fire Company 24 Forest Ranch, the assistant chief there. I've been there for 19 years. I get paid as a firefighter, sometimes like during the lightning strikes that we've just had for the past 6 weeks. But really, I'm a volunteer firefighter. One of the first fires that I was on was the Humboldt Fire that started down very close to Chico. It was very fast moving. The winds were just, you know, ripping. While we were watching it come down, there were embers that crossed the whole canyon, which is probably a half a mile across, maybe a little bit more. And next thing we knew that there was fire on our side of the creek. Within the matter of minutes of my being deployed, it had gone from 150 acres to 600 acres. I mean, fast, very fast. I've gotten a little worried a couple of times when I've been in the heat of a fire, and I've had fire on all four sides of me. And yeah, I've got a little nervous about that, but I've relied on myself and I've relied on my workers who are with me to be at my back. That fire is so powerful. It's so magnificent. And it's so frightening. It's absolutely wonderful. And, I mean, that's hard to use those words about something as devastating as it is, but it's nature at its finest. What pleases me about my work is that I feel at the end of the day that I've done something to help my community. And even with some of the losses that have taken place, which I definitely am sad about, it doesn't go unnoticed, that sadness, you know. For the people who have lost their homes, I know a number of those people personally. But at the end of the day, I know that we do our best. And so that's all I can do at the end of the day is know that I've done my best.
Lorraine Dechter of KCHO at Cal State Chico helped us out with that piece.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note as you head into your weekend, a follow-on to the warning this week from the American College of Emergency Physicians. The good doctors cautioned against walking and trying to send text messages at the same time, not to mention driving while you're doing it, bicycling or anything else. It's bad enough when teenagers do that. Now, imagine your grandmother. The Washington Post reported today on one seniors group in Maryland that's trying to turn seniors on to the joys of texting with some help from AT&T. It's all about market share in the very lucrative texting market, of course. Only 6% of seniors have ever sent a text message, the paper says, compared with almost 75% for younger groups. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 51 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ lost 14 points, 2/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 fell 7 points, about 0.5% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewell. Coming up on Monday, dubious deals online.
When someone has this seemingly unlimited supply of iPods at half the retail price, one has to question, where did these goods come from?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.